The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Timothy Tennant. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
This Hannah is entitled The Central Articles, Islamic Faith and Practice, and covers the theology of the five pillars of Islam that most of you have some familiarity with. However, we will introduce this by yet another great Quranic passage, number 6, but it's in Surah 112, entitled The Unity. If you turn into Surah 112, very short surah, but very, very important one. That's the Bismillah you're hearing. This surah is extremely important. Muslims say that if you recite this surah, you've recited one-third of the entire Quran. That's how important this surah is. This actually reflects Tom's question earlier about why do you have this kind of disconnect between what Muslims believe and what they actually... And then you have to push the word recite. It's great. You just heard one-third of the entire Quran.
Do
you
work the same way when we record our reading
report? Yeah, that's right. If you're in a pinch, just read that one surah and then turn in a report so you That's great. Michael, you know, it's insights like that which will get you a long way in life. What that said, what you heard in Arabic there was actually, Allah is one, the eternal God. He begot none, nor was he begotten. None is equal to him. This surah, as I mentioned, is one-third of the Quran and is believed by Muslims, I mean, there's no doubt, it is the second most quoted surah in the Quran. So today, you've been exposed and actually heard in Arabic as well as our own reading the two most quoted passages in the Quran, the Surah 1 and Surah 112. If you recite this surah, which is only made up of four ayahs, you have actually once again encountered a ability to grasp a lot of the theology of the Quran because it shows you the tremendous anti-Christian polemic that comes through because this particular passage clearly is arguing for a expression of monotheism which is decidedly non-Christian. This is probably one of the most anti-Christian polemics in the Quran, and it is one-third of the Quran. So this is why we have to take it very seriously. According to their belief here that in fact, the way this title, this surah is entitled, The Unity, makes reference to the expression, Allah is one. It actually refers to an interpretation of the word one here. Now, if you go back to your Hebrew class, you may recall the famous Shema, which there's no doubt Muhammad is very well aware of the Shema. What is the Shema? Who can tell me? Yes, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is
one.
Now, that is a very, very important theologically. What in the world does that mean? Shema Israel, Eloheinu, Yaha, Echad. And they say whatever they just said in Arabic. And the whole thing, this Echad, is... this is a very huge point in the Jewish discussions about the Shema, what is meant by the term Echad. Because if you mean by one, if you mean what it most certainly does mean, it is a expression of a God's, Yahweh's unrivaled providence, his sovereignty and all of that. That's clearly the kind of thing that's being said in this text. What it is almost certainly not is a reference to anything about the metaphysical nature of God. In other words, it's not saying Allah is one and therefore the Trinity is impossible. The expression echad has nothing to do, it doesn't say for or against, actually. It's not a statement for or against the Trinity. It's simply not making a commentary on the metaphysical nature of God. It's making a comment on the sovereignty of God. There's only one Yahweh. You know, compared to Baal and Ashtoreth and all the rest, there's only one Yahweh. In that sense, that's exactly the way the Quran is intended to be operative, I think. Allah is one, the eternal God. But the way Muhammad takes the Shahada, or takes the Shema, is to make this into a metaphysical statement, that Allah is one metaphysically. Therefore, he can begot none, nor was he begotten. It carries a distinct anti-Christian theme. The Nicene Creed says, I believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God, begotten of the Father before all worlds, God of God, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made. Again, begotten references the eternal, progression, or eternal procession of the Son from the Father or Father and Son, depends on your and the Spirit from the Father and Son. It is clearly a very different issue than the Jews were wrestling with in the Shema. But in the case of the Muslim interpretation of this, they are clearly interpreting this in an anti-Christian polemic. He begot none, nor was he begotten, is now turned right into the face of the Nicene Creed, saying it is wrong for Christians to say that Jesus is the eternally begotten one, and therefore this is clearly a Christian, anti-Christian polemic. And the fact that Muslims believe that it's one-third of the Quran, it is one of the most quoted Qurans when they go through their salat, their daily prayers. And so this is something that is being heard constantly in the mosques, this particular surah, quoted in its full form there. Okay, so I think it's worth noting that. Let me give you a few quotes from Muslims, and I'll find out if we have any questions about this. One Muslim scholar says, the surah is one-third of the Quran, I mentioned that. One Muslim scholar says in commentary on this passage, heaven and earth are founded on the truth of this surah. Now this is saying, this is a passage which denies in one statement, both the sonship and the deity of Christ are denied in one, couple phrases. And yet, in fact, it is the deity of Christ, his sonship, and the Trinity are all three denied in this surah. And yet, heaven and earth are found in this surah. One Muslim scholar says, along with the Al-Fatah, the opening, the first chapter, it is the essence of the Quran. And listen to this commentary on this surah. He says, to confess this surah is to shed one's sins like a tree sheds leaves in autumn. Now that would obviously be a strong motivation to confess this surah. He's saying, you confess this surah and your sins will be shed like a leaves of a tree in the autumn time. So this becomes almost a daily reminder by Muslims of the denial of the Trinity, sonship of God in Christ and the his deity, and so that becomes obviously one of the reasons why Muslims tend to assess the Quranic view of Christ much more negatively than is actually in the text. This is one of the issues we have to understand. The weight that Muslims put on the Quran, different parts of the Quran, is very different. And that explains some of that. Let's go to these, what I call the unifying principles of Islam. What we will explore in due course of time as the course develops and as we, we're kind of systematically bringing you into the house of Islam, I realize, and you'll see at the end of the course, that we will make all kinds of exceptions and what Muslims here believe this and there believe that, and how we have a lot of variety and diversity in the Muslim community. But these are what we call the unifying principles, because all Muslims everywhere that are regarded as true Muslims, practicing Muslims, not nominal Muslims, but all true practicing Muslims, all agree on these five principles, these five pillars, they're called. In fact, I mentioned earlier that the Muslims metaphorically speak of Islam as the Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam. This is the expression that is used. And it's a house that is upheld by these five pillars, which are known as the five pillars of Islam, which uphold the house of Islam. If you take out any of these pillars, the house collapses or house is weakened. And so even though there are many Muslim groups that have other things they emphasize, these we call the unifying principles of Islam. They are the, you know, in many ways it's an idealized thing. We had students who went to Istanbul for our OMP last year, and they wanted to obviously talk to Muslims. And so they every day they were in the marketplace and they were having a conversation with Muslims and just kind of getting a feel for talking to Muslims. So they found out one of the best ways to get conversation started is to talk about the five pillars, because Muslims know this. And so they were able to do this with many Muslims. But every now and then, every day, they met Muslims who they said to them, do you know the five pillars? And of course they would say, of course I do. And so they said, well, what are they? And I said, okay, it's confession of faith, and it's, jihad, you know, which is not one of them. Almsgiving to the poor, you know, it's, let me think, going to Mecca, you know, they kind of garble their way through it and get two or three of them and say, yeah, that's what it is. You know, reading the Quran, you know, or something like. And so our students were surprised that they actually met Muslims in a city like Istanbul who did not know the five pillars of Islam. One has to realize that it'd be like saying if you walked into Hamilton, or you walked into Hamilton Congregational Church, or you walked into North Shore Community Baptist Church or Christ Church, and there's a guy sitting there on the pew, and you tap on his shoulder, and he looks up, and you say to him, what are the Ten Commandments? And he's like, well, they're, you shall know that God's before me, and then two or three, he starts getting cold. Or you say, what's the Lord's Prayer? You stop somebody in Hamilton and say, are you a Christian? Yes. What's the Lord's Prayer? I don't know. You'd be surprised. You'd be absolutely shocked at the incredible abyss of ignorance that's out there. You ask somebody who's a Christian, you say, well, where is the book of Corinthians found? They say, well, you know, it's somewhere, you know, in the Old Testament. You know, you'll get these kind of things all the time. So it should not shock you too much that there are Muslims who haven't a clue what the five pillars of Islam are. But this doesn't change the fact theologically that these are the unifying principles. These are the key things which I would dare say Muslims, many, many Muslims around the world, literally millions of them, would know all five of these, of course. But I think it's fair to say that you have to recognize the diversity in the Muslim community. The first is the confession of faith, or the Shahada. I bear witness there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. That's the one that we have in the overhead, and there it is before you on the handout. This confession actually, remarkably, though it's viewed as the most important confession in the Muslim community, this is how you enter into the house of Islam. This is the doorway. Anybody who confesses this becomes a Muslim, supposedly. So you're bearing witness of these two realities, that there is no God but Allah, and the second part, that Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. So it's a twofold testimony And the word shahada means the public witness or the testimony, open testimony. Remarkably, however, though this phrase is so important and is spoken in the ears of a newborn child, spoken into the ears of one who dies, it is viewed as such an important entrance into the community. It does not appear in the Quran in this form or anything like this. It's simply not there, as you will find out as you read the Quran. However, its components are found in the Quran. And I think it's well worth it to at least trace this a little bit. Surah 20, Ayah 7 and Ayah 14 are places where you have a statement which sounds a lot like the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments. I am Allah, there is no God but me. Now that statement, if you look at it linguistically, is very, very similar to Yahweh's declaration, there is no God but me, you should know the gods are for me. You find in Surah 112, which we mentioned earlier, this say, Allah, He is one. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh, He is one. Deuteronomy 6:4. These are very, very similar kinds of expressions where the Muslim who says, there's no God but Allah, This resonates with the Quran, though it doesn't appear in that that sense. The statement "there is no God but Allah" is very, very important to exegete properly what they're actually saying, because this becomes very, very important in later discussions in Christian community. Can Christians say there is no God but Allah, or no God but God, the Arabic word for God? Can Christians say this? Not the latter portion. There are many Muslim groups who say, for example, there is no God but Allah, and Jesus is the Word of Allah, because that's the title Jesus given in the Quran, the Word of Allah, or things like this. And so people have debated about this first phrase. What does it mean? If it means, and this largely repeats what our opening declaration of this surah described, if it refers to existence, there is no God but the true God, He's the only God who truly exists, then obviously there's no theological problem with that. Muslims had long acknowledged the existence of the God Allah before Muhammad. So the question is, why would this phrase be so significant? What is the significance of saying there's no God but Allah? It's got to be more than existence, though some try to interpret it that way. If you are saying that it is truly in keeping with the Shema, and it's basically saying there is no God but Allah or Yahweh, and He is God alone, which I think is a good translation of Echad there, if in fact it's saying alone, then that is very much in keeping with the general Old Testament belief. The fact that it would be actually said in negative terms. There is no God but Allah. The emphasis would be on the negation of it. That Muhammad's mission was not primarily to inform them of Allah's existence, which would be apparently presumed by most people had heard of the word Allah, but to proclaim Allah's unrivaled sovereignty. That, in other words, Allah is God over against false claims of idols, which is very much in keeping with the Quran. So if you interpret this first phrase of the Shahada, I bear witness no God but Allah, if you interpret along Jewish lines, consistent with Jewish interpretation and consistent with the Quran itself in terms of Muslims' context of denouncing idols, then it is not a particularly difficult phrase for Christians to come to grips with, this first phrase. This Quranic support for this comes from Surah 37, Ayah 35. In that surah, you have the closest thing to the actual first phrase of the Shahada quoted by Muhammad. Let me read it to you. Listen carefully to this. On that day they will share our punishment. For when it was said to them by Muhammad, there is no God but Allah. So this sounds like Muhammad is actually quoting the Shahada to them. When it was said to them, there is no God but Allah, they reply with scorn, are we to renounce our gods for the sake of a mad poet? Which means, in the context of the Quran, they are hearing the Shahada, this first phrase, as an issue of his unrivaled providence and sovereignty, not a question of metaphysics. That they're not, to say there's no God but Allah is not tying into this oneness idea of Surah 112. It is not saying there is no God but Allah, therefore you can't have Jesus or the Holy Spirit. That is not what is found here in this first phrase. If you if interpret it within its own context, if that line of reason is accepted, then, which is my basic position on this, there's no fundamental objection theologically with the first phrase of the Shahada. The problem, of course, is the interpretation of it in anti-Christian ways, and of course the linking of it with Muhammad's prophethood. Of that we have obviously serious problems. But we have to address whether or not the Muslim view of Allah is fundamentally, can it, in these kind of statements, is it an exclusion of Trinitarianism? Because obviously in the Christian proclamation we must proclaim a Trinitarian view of monotheism. Others argue that in fact this is this idea of no God but Allah is explicitly used to denounce essentially Trinitarianism, because in Muhammad's mind, Trinitarianism is polytheism. And so along this argument, Muhammad does not see theologically any difference between the Christian view of Trinitarianism and a view of polytheism, which believes in three separate deities. To Muhammad, this is all the same. And therefore, to Muhammad, to squibble about denying the Trinity versus denying idols is for Muhammad a non-issue, because to him, the Trinity is idolatry. It is polytheism. My problem with that is that, but from the Christian point of view, it is not. Those are two very, very different things. And so we have to, this is a theologically complex issue, but we have to be able to at least recognize the main issues that are found in this first phrase. And my argument is essentially, this phrase is asserting Allah's sovereignty and unrivaled providence, as you find there on the handout. That's the main point of this first phrase. The second phrase is, of course, shifts dramatically, focus on Muhammad as the prophet of Allah. Again, though the whole Shahada is not found in the Quran, this latter portion does begin to appear in the later surahs of the Quran. For example, Surah 48:9 begins to make a connection theologically in the Quran, which I think is quite interestingly done. Muhammad starts out as basically saying, "I am this mad poet. I am this I'm illiterate. I'm just empty vessel that Gabriel has chosen," and there's a real downplay of Muhammad as a person and who he is and his importance. Gradually, you begin to find the Quran linking belief in Allah with acceptance of Muhammad's message. These two begin linked. If you accept Muhammad, that is tantamount to accepting Allah. If you reject Muhammad, that is rejecting Allah. So in Surah 48, Ayah 9, it says, "Those that swear loyalty to you," this is Allah saying about Muhammad, "swear loyalty to Allah." Now that is a very powerful, that's like, imagine Moses saying to people, "Well, if you swear allegiance to me, that's the same as swearing allegiance to Yahweh." That's the theological step that is being taken by Muhammad here. "Those that swear loyalty to you swear loyalty to Allah." The connection is made. Muhammad in Surah 48:29, that same surah which is devoted largely to promoting his apostleship. Muhammad is Allah's apostle. Notice what he does in Ayah 15. These are all the same surah. This is the very next one. Surah 49, 15. Where he says this. The true believers are those that have faith in Allah and His apostle and never doubt. So now you're seeing an equating going on where he begins to equate faith in Allah with faith in the Muhammad. You have faith in Allah, you have faith in Muhammad. These are going to be theologically equivalent expressions of faith. And even more remarkably, I find in Surah 4, Ayah 80, he that obeys the apostle obeys Allah himself. To obey Muhammad is to obey Allah. Now, Muslims claim that the intent of these texts is not to exalt Muhammad, but to exalt the fact that Muhammad is the conduit through which the true revelation comes. And so what they would say by this is that when you say, I witness there was no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah, they say what that latter phrase is really intended to do is merely to affirm the integrity and the inerrancy of the Quran, because Muhammad is the conduit through which the Quran comes. And so this is a way of linking, essentially, Allah to Allah's word. You have Allah. Remember, cosmologically, Allah cannot cross over into our world. So you have this cosmological void here. So here we are down here in the seeing world. Gabriel transmits the word from Allah down to Muhammad. Here's Muhammad at this level. Here's all the Muslim people. Muhammad is the conduit and channel through which the word of Allah is spoken. So rather than saying there is no God but Allah and the Quran is the word of Allah, which would make total sense to us theologically, they instead are arguing that they are affirming the prophet of Allah, and that will basically accomplish the same thing, since Muhammad's whole life and mission is to deliver successfully the Quran. But to be fair, it is much more than that. It's become much more than that, because if it was only the Quran that was being affirmed in this passage, then why not just say so? Why not just say there is no God but Allah and the Quran is the word of Allah? The fact is, Muhammad is given special place because he is viewed as the first Muslim to submit in this new era, you know, this new revelation, this new post-Quranic period. So therefore, because he's the first to submit to Allah and worship Him, he becomes supremely important. And he essentially revives the tradition of Adam, Abraham, and now Muhammad. He kind of carries on the famous monotheistic tradition that goes back to the Black Stone and back to creation. And Muhammad becomes the supreme example of a true Muslim. So you have essentially a person who lives out the faith. Now this is very important because at this point, if you interpret this passage as merely the Quran, then it de-emphasizes the role of Muhammad. He becomes just a conduit through which the whole thing flows. He's like a pipe. Because he has dictation theory, there's no acknowledgement of his own style or any input. He's just a conduit. But in fact, as we will see as the course develops, again, some of this we have to anticipate, we can't go into at this point, but Muhammad is clearly not just the conduit of revelation in the Islam, because the Hadith, which is this other major book of revelation, which you have selections of, but is actually a very massive work, far more voluminous than the Quran, is based on Muhammad's actions and his life and what he did and what he said and how he thought about everything imaginable. And that is now a source of revelation and is viewed on par with the Quran. So because of that, Muhammad cannot be viewed as a merely passive instrument. He is the first Muslim. He is the great example, and his, what they call his sunnah, or his example, is now been written down in these little narratives called hadith. And that is used authoritatively by Muslim law courts. You must do this because that's how Muhammad did it. Or this is how Islam is to be governed and operate in the world. So I think we have to recognize that in the Shahada, we have both a dramatic affirmation of Allah and His sovereignty, as well as an affirmation of Muhammad's unique role, which includes, yes, bringing the Quran, but also includes his own example and his personhood, because theologically it's exactly how Muhammad has functioned as Islam has developed. And therefore, this particular confession is extremely important theologically because it actually performs basically the basis for all of the revelation, both the Quran and the Hadith. Essentially flows out of the basic confession of faith which all Muslims make when they enter into the household of Islam or they publicly profess their faith in the Islamic religion. Okay, the second unifying principle is known as Salat. This is a extremely important, again, this is also another one that is widely known by all Muslims. There are actually two kinds of prayer in Islam. One is called the dua, one is called the salat. The dua is something we'll have to mention from time to time in this course. It is the closest thing to spontaneous prayer that you have in Islam. This would be where many of our prayers would fall in the category of dua. Salat refers to a ritual prayer. And this is actually, when most Muslims refer to prayer, think about prayer, they generally think about the salat. And once again, we will see as the course develops, there are groups, particularly the Sufi, which emphasize all kinds of spontaneous things. They have like big charismatic gatherings and all. But this is something not in mainstream Islam. So most Muslims understand ritualized prayer that happens in a formalized way in certain distinct time periods of the day, etc. And it happens with several kinds of components to it. And I want to show you each of the components. The first is called, the first part of this salat is the call to prayer. You're actually called to pray this particular prayer that's prayed. And this prayer has, as you can see, if you look, glance down on the handout, there are actually four major components of the salat. But before you even begin the salat, it begins with the call to prayer. The call to prayer is known as the adhan. Adhan is the term for the call to prayer. The person who issues the call to prayer is a special figure known as a muezzin. One of the things that Muslims will often say, and I'll go and give you now the response back. If you witness to Muslims, they will often gently chastise Christians by saying, "Your call to prayer is done by bells." They're thinking here about church bells that ring, you know, and call people to church, which was very much a part of the American scene for much of our history. But it's not a bell that goes forth over the Muslim community. It's the human voice. And the human voice, you know, crying out, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah is most great, Allah is most great. This human voice is viewed as a very powerful thing that is contrasted to the uninspired, unredeemed sound of a human bell. In fact, most Muslim prayer, the minarets from which the prayer comes, normally the muezzin climbs the top of the minaret, and there's usually two or three storied minarets in a mosque, and you go to the very top of the minaret. And he will call the adhan, the muezzin will call, issue the adhan. But today it is not done by human voice as much, or an actual person, but as a loudspeaker. that's attached to the top of the minaret, and it just comes on at predetermined times. So I will say to Muslims, when was the last time you actually saw a living muezzin climb the steps and actually shout out, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar? You know, it's actually quite rare. Instead, either some chap turns on the switch or it's all done through the times are done. And I actually have some photographs of some muezzins that do issue the call to prayer that I've found over the years. I've got to get a picture of that because it is quite rare. So I said, I think the bells are nicer than the because often it's very crackly, very crackly, bad recordings of it. But what you have here is actually the call to prayer. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, God is great, God is great. That is said three times, three or four times, sometimes many more than that. And then you have the Shahada. I testify or I bear witness, there is no God but God. Ashuhadu an la ilah il Allah. Again, the alliteration is incredible. I testify that Muhammad is the apostle or prophet of Allah. Ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulu Allah. And then come to prayer. Come to prayer. In the morning times, they will often add, prayer is better than sleep. Come to prayer. Come to prayer. God is come to success. Sometimes they'll say, come to divine service, particularly to the Friday prayer. They'll say that, Friday noon prayer. There's slight variations to this. God is most great. God is most great. And then, again, there is no God but Allah. Listen to the alliteration of this, because Muslims will often, will really talk about the beauty of this. Now, most people who live there find it very annoying, but from the Muslim point of view, it's supposed to be very beautiful. Listen to this. There is no God but Allah. La ilaha illa Allah. The alliteration is very, very present in this call to prayer. Sometimes it's preceded by long readings from the Quran, Surah 112, the Surah 1 may be read. Sometimes it's like lengthy things that are read. It may not be this short. It again depends on where you are and what the practices may be. But the prayer, this basic prayer is called the Adhan. The person who calls is called the Muezzin. The traditional place that it is issued from is the minaret, and that is it isn't a steeple, but it's a extended area on the roof of the mosque, which goes up very high, and you can see this. Okay, once you're called to prayer, then there are four basic aspects of the salat. The first is the ablution. This is a form of cleansing, which is extremely important. It's a ritual washing that prepares oneself to enter into the divine presence. The cleansing involves, the most idealized version of this, you change one's clothes. If dirty, you wash your face and neck from the elbow to the tips of the fingers, from the ankles to the feet. And that is explicitly taught in the Quran of what to cleanse. So in that sense, you have to say that is the word of Allah. This is what Allah commands. This is found, by the way, in Surah 5:6. I have placed on the handout the references for this so that you will not have to wonder where it's to be found. Let me just read it to you. Believers, when you rise to pray, wash your faces and your hands as far as the elbow and wipe your heads and your feet to the ankle. This is something that is, again, very much drawn from Jewish practice. The Jews, if you go and look at texts like in Exodus 30, 17 to 21, or Exodus 40, 30 to 32, You find the removal, the washing of face, hands, and feet are done before entering the divine presence, exactly as Muhammad has done. In fact, Muslims even follow the same order as the Jews. First face, then hands, then feet. Exactly the same order that the Muslims follow, or the one the Jews followed. The Muslims remove their shoes as a part of this. As you go into any mosque, you'll see that here's the mosque, here's the minaret, and there's usually an entrance area of some kind, and there'll be a little boy there taking collections up to look after your shoes while you go in. And, of course, the Jews removed their shoes when they entered into the divine presence. So there are Jewish parallels to all of these. So the ablution. Now, one of the things that's interesting, especially in light of Christian debate about baptism and how much water and all of this, and the early church came out, what do you do with Christians from Egypt who came to Christ and they want enough water to baptize or immerse or whatever. And the different, as you know, the Didache indicated, well, just use what water you can find kind of thing. And this is, of course, started this big debate about how much water is necessary to baptize somebody. In the same way, the Muslims are the same thing. What do you do if you're out in the desert? I mean, obviously, Arabia is filled with deserts. You don't always have access to water, or you have just enough water for your to drink to get through the day, if you're traveling especially. And so many Muslims, you'll see them when they go into the mosque, like if you're in an airport especially. I've seen this a lot in airports where there's no, they just have a little prayer room there or something. Because most mosques, out of the mosque, they'll have a little ablution area, a little fountain or something you clean up, and then you go into the mosque. Or an airport, they'll just have like a prayer room. Or if you're on a plane and you're in 30,000 feet, they have many, if you find a Muslim airline, they will have the direction of prayer on the screen. Have you ever noticed that? And they'll show you where Mecca is in relation to where you are on the plane. So, they have these kind of helps, but you don't have any running water. So they would take sand and go through the motions, the ritual motions of cleansing with sand. Or you often will see Muslims, they'll do this, and they'll go like this just with their hands. And they're going through the motions. There's no water. There's no, like handy towelettes or something like that. It's just going through the, it shows you the ritualistic aspect of this. You go through a ritual cleansing, and whether or not you have water or not is not as critical as, so it's not so much you must be clean, it's much you must go through the ritual cleansing. It's in that sense, more symbolic. The second feature of the Salat is the direction of prayer, what they call the Qibla. The Qibla is found in Surah 2, Ayah 144, where he says, many a time we have seen you turn your face towards heaven. We will make you turn towards a Qibla. Turn towards the holy mosque. Wherever you are, face it. This is the direction of prayer where they face toward the Kaaba. I've already mentioned that this was a change because the early Muslims in the pre-Medinan period did face toward Jerusalem. On the way to Medina, there's the famous mosque there called the Mosque of the Two Qiblas. And this is the place where Muhammad supposedly changed, and rather than facing west, faced to east, as it were, symbolically west to east. That change is found in the Quran itself, some of the objections people made about that. So you'll find in mosques, if you go inside a mosque, you'll find a prayer niche, they usually will call it. The prayer niche is called a mihrab. A mihrab is a prayer niche shows you the direction of prayer, and often the imam, which in the Sunni community is the priest figure, the prayer leader, really is what you should say. The prayer leader will stand in that place and preach or teach or whatever. So that, therefore, there's always an orientation. When you walk into a mosque, you always know which direction the Kaaba is in. You don't have to look for it. You don't have to bring a compass along, look at the sun or whatever. It's always shown. In fact, one of the interesting things about constructions of mosques around the world is that the Muslim theology of mosque is very different from a Christian, I say unfortunately, I don't think it really is different, but unfortunately different from often our practice of what a church is. Because typically Christians have made the identification of church and building, as you know. So what happened is in missionary work, missionaries tended to focus on building buildings when they got a church started all over the world. There's very few exceptions to this around the world. This has been a kind of a typical approach, especially 19th century. So what happened was when you had a community that was established, it takes time and energy and a lot of resources to build a building. Even if it's a concrete building with a tin roof, it takes time and energy. And it tended to slow the missionary movement down. The Muslim missionaries were much more, as a rule, much more mobile. And I have, when I was in Africa, I went to a lot of Muslim areas, and I took a lot of pictures to prove this point, because I suspected it to be true. But I would go to village to village to village where the only, quote, mosque they had was a circle, a clearing of some property and circle of rocks. They would circle some rocks in a area and clean this off very nice and flat, and they would have a place that showed where Mecca was, basically a mihrab, showing the Qibla, the direction of prayer. And that was the mosque. So the word mosque literally means place of prostration, and there's a place of prayer. It is actually a corruption of another word, the word masjid, which means prostration, the word mosque. So it means place of prostration. So it's amazing that the Muslims have literally legislated tons of things about prayer. What direction to pray, how many times to pray, what to do before you pray, the very motions of prayer, we'll see in a moment, all these things. But they never, ever say a word about the place that you pray. There's no emphasis of place. The place is mobile. Anywhere you are, wherever you are, whenever you're there from a plane or an airport, doesn't matter, you pray. And if you have your prayer mat, you put it down and you pray. In that sense, that's a very mobile kind of theology of prayer, which I find to be one of the things that I think has been very impressive about the Muslim community's ability to transport prayer in the marketplace. One of the things that Muslims often say, and I think this is to our shame because I don't think it's true to our theology by any means, but Muslims will often refer to Christians as the prayerless ones, those who don't pray. Now, I can think of 1,000 things that we would say in response to that. I mean, number one, we don't believe in praying, you know, loud public prayers for ostentatious purposes. We don't believe in these kind of, you know, formalized prayers that are done for show and all that. But on the other hand, the emphasis on prayer, it's very, very central to Muslim way of life. In that sense, I think that we can appreciate that whole concept. Muslims have their own little theological squabbles about the direction of prayer. One of the things that Muslims will say is there are actually two places on earth where you can face any direction you want when you pray. One, if you are in the actual grand open-air mosque of Mecca, if you're inside that huge mosque in Mecca, you know, you're there. You're at the Kaaba, so you can face anywhere you want inside that that prayer thing. Okay, it makes sense. The other thing that some Muslim scholar thought of was that if you are on the antipodes of Mecca, on the other side of the world, like I guess if you're in the middle of the, you know, Pacific or something, South Pacific on a boat, I don't know what is exactly on the antipodes of Mecca, but if you're on the antipodes of Mecca, then you can face any direction you want. So they have their own little, you know, midrashic tradition of, you know, squabbling with little things like that, and can be quite amusing. But clearly the direction of prayer is also influenced by Jewish practice. As you know, the Jews prayed toward Jerusalem, Daniel 6, verse 10. You find Daniel open his windows and praying toward Jerusalem. The practice is regulated by the Jewish Talmud. And, of course, as I mentioned, until really wasn't legislated until the second AH, second year after the Hejra, the Muslims began to pray toward the Kaaba. So that's something we've already discussed. So the cleansing, the direction of prayer, the movements of prayer, the rak'ah, is another, again, famous and also taken from Jewish practice, prescribed way of praying. These are seven movements which are ritualized that form a ritualized prayer when you form the salat. And essentially, you have the following seven movements. The first movement is the standing. You're standing like this. You face the Qibla. I'm facing Mecca. You place your hand over your ear, cup your ears like this, and you say the what's called the takbir. That is a very important term. That is the expression, Allahu Akbar, God is great, is called the takbir. You essentially, it's a way of affirming the oneness and greatness of Allah. God is great, or God is the greatest. And then you stand, second position, where you fold hands in front of your waist like this. And so you'll see Muslims, they'll be, I'm going to pretend you're east now so you can see what I'm doing. So this position number one, this position number two, your hands are folded across your waist, and you recite the first chapter of the Quran, Surah 1, the opening. So again, that's why I said that's said, you know, all these times every day. The third is a bowing from the hips like this, and you put your hand on your knees like that, and you extend one finger. Now, this is the way it was taught in a Muslim school to young boys. When they go through their school, they're taught how to do this. Not every Muslim will do it exactly this way, but this is where you're supposed to do it. Put your hand like that and raise one finger. Now, the one finger raised, which happens throughout the prayer, is an acknowledgement of the oneness of Allah. All right, so this, there's no God but one. Again, that's the big, big debate. What does that one finger mean? Does it mean monotheism? If so, we have no problem with that. Or is it some kind of thing about metaphysical unity of God where he can have no persons of the Trinity and all that, which I think has nothing to do with that. But this is the similar issue that comes up whenever Muslims say there's one God. The fourth position is, again, standing followed by a complete prostration. You come down, and you come all the way down, and your head will touch the floor. How many times have Gordon Conwell professors gone through the call to prayer or the motions of prayer for you? So you go all the way down, your head to the ground, and you're making confessions of Allah's greatness. You raise body again to sitting position like this after you've knelt down. This is what you often see in the pictures like on television where they'll have like hundreds of Muslims in a big mosque and they're all there together. And if you'll notice, sometimes they'll have their finger out like that. Again, that's the same thing, the oneness of Allah. And then when he gives the call, this will be on a Friday where they do it together. Everybody goes down. And they come up, and they'll even have little tape on the floor of mosque. If you ever go inside mosque, you'll see so everybody lines up nice and straight. You know, it's a very visual thing that's done. Now, once you rise up, again, the raised body is number five, the prostration is number six, and then the seventh is once again sitting for silent prayer, and you... During this prayer, again, Muhammad's practice was to turn your face side to side to acknowledge symbolically the ummah, that, you know, there's others with you praying. Even if you're by yourself, you turn your head side to side and acknowledge the ummah. That's important because, as you know, the Jewish practice was also this. The prostration is very, very important in the Jewish point. I also mentioned, I have typed out here only because students often ask me about this, and so I used to just kind of go through it quickly, but according to the schools, if you're a young Muslim boy and you attend Islamic schools, they will teach you that every one of the five prayers, there are five of these during the day, that there are prescribed ways that you do the rak'ahs, the movement. So for example, the morning prayer, you will do two cycles out loud. So you do the whole thing about God is great, etc., all that out loud, the first of the Quran, etc. The noon prayer, four cycles silent. Late afternoon, four cycles silent. So that would be four cycles silent would mean, in other words, 7 times 4 is 28, 28 different movements going through the whole thing four times. Sunset prayer, three cycles, two out loud, one silent. Night prayer, four cycles, two out loud, two silent. My experience, and I'd be quite interested in anybody else's experience who's lived the Muslim world, my experience is that many, many times, even if you're in the afternoon prayer, clearly silent. If you're in the sunset prayer, where two of them are out loud, one silent, many Muslims will do the three cycles silent. They simply won't follow this. You tell them, wait a minute, you're not doing it according to the book. He says, well, we didn't know there was a book, you know. They may not, this is again one of these things where there's a disconnect between practice, but this whole thing is legislated, you know, the times, the movements, that's the main thing to recognize. And also, when they're sitting there at the last seventh rakah, then certain prayers and confessions are made, again, quoting the Quran. And I think I want to just, real quick, and then we'll be done, write down for you the a list of the six most quoted surahs by Muslims during the prayer time, because I think this says a lot theologically about where Muslims are, how they actually encounter the Quran. Surah 1, Surah 112, which we looked at today in depth, Surah 114, Surah 2, 255, that verse, Surah 25, 35, Surah 59, 22 to 24.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.